This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson on this, as I said, kind of a raw Sunday morning. Temperatures chilly out there. Still a lot of mist, moisture, drizzle in the air. But some good news. I just saw Mike Hamernick posted the latest forecast. And we're actually looking, according to Mike, to 70 degrees on Tuesday. So maybe some early kind of relief, and we can finally get into May a little bit here instead of feeling like March. We were talking about the national political scene and the idea of a brokered convention being a possibility. A lot to be determined yet as far as the delegate slates, but all this talk about Paul Ryan, the House Speaker, who, you know, keeps saying, I'm not a backup candidate for president. I'm not going to be the guy. It's not going to happen. But he keeps putting out these videos, and he just put out another video talking about his leadership in the House. And this one's even got some background music to it.
I think the polls basically say about 7 out of 10 of Americans think that America's headed in the wrong direction. Okay. Then as a member of Congress, it is not our job simply to say we are just as angry as the rest of everybody else. It is not our job to just put gas on the fire. It is our job to channel this concern, this fear, this anxiety, this anger into solutions, into ideas on how to fix it. America, we have problems that we can fix, and we need to do this together.
That's House Speaker Paul Ryan. Paul Ryan, I am not a candidate for president, Paul Ryan. We're going to talk now to my good friend Jeff Cohen, Tribune colleague, a great writer and investigative reporter, and we're going to talk about the sentencing of former U.S. House Speaker Dennis Hastert to 15 months in prison. Jeff, thanks for getting up with me this morning.
Hey, Rick, sure. That's quite the segue there.
From one House Speaker to another, yes.
Speaking of House Speakers, the music was really getting me going there. I'm ready for you now.
Good. Well, if you would just, I mean, you've done so much work on this story. If you could just, though, for people who have never been inside a federal courtroom, could you just kind of give us a sense of the environment of what was going on that day last week?
Yeah, I can do that. Just for the record, I was actually doing a lot of our web rewrite since I've been with the story for a long time.
Right.
And so I was actually at a place where I could get to a computer and keep everybody up to date that way. So I was listening mostly to the audio in terms of what actually occurred. But just in terms of the environment, I mean, I can tell you that I think the last time that building saw anything quite like that was probably Blagojevich.
That's what
I figured. In terms of the amount of media that was there and just kind of the electricity, if you will, that was there. I mean, somebody of that sort of magnitude. I don't know if anybody did a great deal of research, but this is one of the highest ranking public officials of any kind in U.S. history to face a prison sentence. I mean, you must be able to talk about this caliber of public official on your hands when you talk about who is facing this kind of
third in line to the presidency.
Exactly. And I think that theme kind of carried itself through the hearing. The judge, said a number of times just how shocking this was. At one point said, how can you have serial child molester and former Speaker of the House in the same sentence? It just, really was an amazing day. And I felt like everybody sort of thought that prison was a really strong likelihood for Hastert. And I think he probably knew that going in. But, you never quite know. We've had situations where, sentences for politicians haven't been as tough as some people would want, and there have been other times where that hasn't been the case. But everybody's really just interested to see how the final chapter was going to play out. And Mr. Hastert showed up for court in a wheelchair, and there was a sense that his defense was really trying to point out that this is a person who's in his last days, in his last months probably, and looking for a little bit of sympathy that way. So you had all these kind of factors coming together, and it made for an interesting hearing for sure, very memorable one, I think, for the city.
Well, and even I believe Judge Durkin said that he was not delivering a prison sentence as a death sentence.
Yeah, that was definitely a factor for the judge. And he, I think most people who observed it and listened to it were struck by the fact that the judge had really done a lot of his own research. He had spoken to physicians who were familiar with Hastert's situation and said that he had, in fact, suffered a catastrophic health event recently, which his lawyers have said was a stroke. And he had, you know, turned around and gone to Bureau of Prisons officials and made sure that there are facilities that can handle the type of care that Hastert needs so that, you know, he, like you say, he wouldn't effectively be killing him by giving him a sentence of any length. And I think he was satisfied that there are health facilities in the federal prison system, you know, where Hastert can get the kind of care that, you know, you'd expect as far as a humane sentence here in this country and what that would look like. And I think it sounds like when they get back together, the two sides in this case in the next month, 2 months, whatever it winds up being, they will have, you know, figured out a site where he can go and serve up a sentence and still maintain some level of health.
One thing that I was struck by, and part of this is media related, was the initial kind of on the part of some news organizations to note that Hastert was getting 2 years of supervised release, and people were running with that like that was all he was going to get. While this was a pretty lengthy sentencing hearing.
Yeah, and I think some of that may have to do with, you know, the experience level of people who were there covering it. I don't know exactly how you know, those organizations had kind of gamed it out, but apparently there was a ruling recently where. At the appeals level, where it was felt that conditions of supervised release were kind of being lost in the shuffle on sentencing days, where you'd have the kind of the emotional burst of finding out what the sentence is, and then the supervised release would be described, and nobody's really paying attention. And so, in the effort to address that, the judge basically set some of those conditions beforehand, sort of as he built up to the sentence. And I think that caused some confusion when the judge is spending a long time talking about 2 years of supervised release and what that's going to be like, that people got ahead of themselves and said that that was going to be the sentence, where the judge was basically just describing the whole scenario. And at one point, he even said, I'm going to get to my decision on custody in a moment, but let me just describe this for you. But if you're trying to take notes and tweet and do whatever else it is you're doing, you can miss that quick line. And I think some people did.
Well, and I think that that pronouncement came even before the victims gave their testimony.
Yeah, he was just trying to get some of the, you know, detailed stuff out of the way, you know, so he could get to the main point of what they were there for. And I think it did create some confusion, you know, to come to the defense of some people who probably wished they could have a do-over. But it was a little bit confusing at the beginning there.
Well, and so he gets 15 months. You have the dramatic testimony of one victim, who turns out to be the brother of former Illinois House Republican leader Tom Cross. And you have that testimony. And and then you also have the acknowledgement that Hastert asked Tom Cross to write a letter in support of him to the court.
You know, I mean, it really made for a very interesting federal sentencing hearing, for sure. And you don't usually have this kind of setup where, you know, the underlying charge, I mean, it's a criminal charge, but it's, you know, it's sort of pedestrian as far as some federal cases would go. It's, you know, structuring withdrawals of your own cash, you know, for something that you want to do with it. And that's not something that people typically get long sentences for. But this case wasn't really about that, and I think everybody knew it, including the judge. He said he made it very clear that I think that your prior conduct and character could speak to what happens in the sentence, and everybody knew exactly what that was. And he said, you know, you've talked about how this was crimes that occurred decades ago, but really, as you were trying to get away from this, you told the FBI about a year ago that individual A was extorting you. So you're putting an extortion case falsely on someone. That just happened. And the judge was obviously very upset about that. He said, in the course of doing that, you manipulated the FBI. You manipulated the U.S. Attorney's Office. Those are huge problems for you. So he was basically, while he was sentencing him for the underlying structure case, which has statutory max and guideline calculations have been made for Mr. Hastert based on his criminal history – which capped the sentence at about 6 months. But it wasn't really about that, and the judge made it very clear. Most of what he talked about was not the violation of the structuring laws. It was that he believed the victims, that he thought that, you know, Hastert was a pretty cold individual to not only victimize individual A when he was a teenager, but then just recently to try to put a case like that on him that brought the full attention of the FBI against that person. So it really led to a buildup, and the judge went, you know, even well over the guideline calculation for Mr. Hastert. That's the reason why.
We're speaking with Jeff Cohen, investigative reporter for the Chicago Tribune. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase studio. And on the phone is Jeff Cohen, investigative reporter for the Chicago Tribune, one of my great Tribune colleagues. We're talking about the sentencing of former U.S. House Speaker Dennis Hastert to 15 months in federal prison. We've got a call from Ron. Ron, welcome to the Sunday Spin.
Good morning, Rick, and to your guests. Two things I want to ask you all. As a result of this case, do you think there will now be a greater discussion in terms of looking at the statute of limitation, particularly as it relates to acts, crimes against someone of that age? But also, guys, I had to point this out. There has to be something wrong with a criminal justice system when a governor gets 14 years for attempting to sell a Senate seat, gets 14 years, and then Hastert gets 15 months. It's just something. I know the legal system is not perfect, but something is terribly wrong with that. So thanks, guys.
All right, Ron, thanks for your question. Jeff, I mean, let's face it, we hear the talk, too, about people questioning that 15 months and, you know, right. Was that enough? And, you know, that is part of the problem of what he actually was being charged with.
Yeah, I mean, well, first of all, the two parts there. Number one, the answer is yes. I think we saw Lisa Madigan at the end of last week talk about, you know, maybe exploring just that thing. And, you know, that's an issue that has come up before, especially in cases involving priests, unfortunately, where, you know, there's a lot of conduct that's decades old, and sometimes it can be difficult.
Right,
to prosecute those.
The issue of statute of limitations having
statute of limitations, correct. Oh, you know, those cases can be different, though, because often the Catholic Church has moved priests out of this or that diocese and even out of state. And by doing that, they actually stop the statute of limitations because it's calculated as an attempt to avoid prosecution. But that's beside the point. But anyway, I think that is going to be explored, number one. Number two, yeah, it's very hard to compare case to case. I think that would be the answer that you would get from most people in the federal system. If every single one of these happens and it's carried by its own merit and it's affected by the limits of the laws that are in place right now. Zach Barton addressed the sentence, the U.S. attorney, after this was handed down and basically said it's not perfect. It's what we have. We felt like it was given a fair handling here, and we just have to deal with what we have here. With Blagojevich, you had somebody who was in office during some of these, you know, alleged crimes, and he actually tried to use that to his own benefit and corrupted, you know, the highest office in Illinois. And the judge in that case, Judge Zagel, saw that as very severe and said basically that he was helping to perpetuate the problems in Illinois. And see, when you have somebody who's actually in office and corrupting their posts, that carries a lot of different weight in the federal system than this, even though it's a horrible crime. Number one, it would have been a state crime. It was decades ago, so the statute was expired. And number three, he was being charged with something different anyway, you know, sort of a lesser financial crime. So the judge had to take all that into account and just come up with something that he felt was at least some punishment. And he did say, just, you know, also for the record, that if Hastert were younger and in better health, the sentence probably would have been higher. So what we talked about earlier did come into play as well. He did not want to administer a death sentence to Dennis Hastert given his condition.
Yeah, and again, this goes back to if the statute hadn't run, it actually would have been a state crime, and there would have been a state prosecution involved for the offenses
right.
that he committed in Yorkville.
Well, we've actually seen it too in organized crime cases where you have a lot of murders and something like Family Secrets, and there isn't a federal statute for murder, really. I mean, that would have been a state case, and that was used at the sentencing phase against a bunch of Chicago mobsters. So it's another event where you've got people actually being killed and they're not being sentenced for it directly.
I thought one of the real ironies in all of this is that you have, as I mentioned, the one victim, Scott Cross, the brother of Tom Cross, the former Illinois House Republican leader, who helped rise through the assistance of Denny Hastert. And then you have Judge Thomas Durkin, who's the brother of the man who replaced Tom Cross as the Illinois House Republican leader. I mean, it's something you can't write that,
you really can't. But you would know better than any of us, Rick, but sort of what a small circle that winds up being when you get into some of these upper echelon political areas. Everybody kind of knows everybody else. It wound up making things very interesting for sure. And I think that, not only did it take a lot of gall to kind of write that letter to Tom Cross, but that actually put individual D into court. That's what he's told us, is that he was basically going to stay silent until Hastert took that step. And then he was like, okay, well now, that's too much for me. And he decided to come forward.
You kind of touched on this earlier, the fact of the more recent crime that he committed of trying to steer the resources of the federal government against individual A and as an extortion. And I thought it was fascinating that when federal agents first talked to Hastert at his home in Plano, it was out of concern that there was some kind of extortion going on.
That's exactly correct. The judge sort of peeled that back a little bit for us. And obviously he had read many more of the reports than were made public. And so we got that little taste of how the FBI approached Hastert and wanted to make sure that his family was okay. And I think federal agents would tell you that that's part of the point of the structuring laws that actually Hastert pleaded guilty to violating. When the federal government sees systematic withdrawals like that in excess of $10,000, there can be harmless explanations, but often it's because there's something nefarious going on. Somebody's being forced to pay somebody off. Somebody's using that cash, especially if you're a politician in the mix, in some sort of bribery or favor making or whatever it might be. So it raises some concern. So when the FBI went to Dennis Hastert, they're thinking, this could be A, B, or C. And the one thing they wanted to make sure was, are you okay? I mean, not only had he been a politician, but he was a lobbyist. He'd done a lot of overseas travel. They have no idea if somebody's gotten to him and is trying to harm somebody he knows or whatever. So they did reach out to him at first and say, is everything okay? And, things went down the line from there. And instead of, first acknowledging what this was about, and the judge even said, if you had been honest, I don't know if we would have been here today.
Right.
Esther came up with a story that kind of covered the conduct, but instead of admitting the underlying part of it, put it on A, saying that there's this, he's making this allegation of sex abuse or whatever it was, and he's extorting me. And the FBI turned around and went at individual A quietly, went into his banking records and phone taps and all that kind of stuff and really tried to make a case on A as if that were true. And the judge was really kind of upset by that and said, not only did you victimize him years ago, but again, you try to make a victim out of him. This is a year ago.
Right, a double victimization. We've got a call from Rich. Rich, welcome to the Sunday Spin.
Yeah, it's a shame because what he did to those kids, I don't think he got enough of anything. He's just another scumbag politician is what he is. Look at Rostenkowski, another one. All these guys, it just goes on and on. And they're always from Illinois, or most of them.
All right, Rich. Thank you. Well, and here again, this goes to the point, Jeff, that we were talking about is even the judge acknowledges, this is the case that's before him. And when it comes to the sentencing, it's what is in front of him.
Exactly. And I mean, it's important to note that the guideline calculations, which are made before someone's sentenced by the probation department of the federal system, they will look at the person's history. Have they ever been charged with a crime before? There are different points that you would get for how much money was involved, and all those things go into an advisory range that the judge gets, which in Hastert's case was 0 to 6 months. He hadn't been charged with anything before, clean record, decent public service record, et cetera. and the conduct in this case was enough for the judge to more than double the maximum end of that. So it was fairly severe with what you've seen, and this judge even said, I've rarely gone above guidelines. They are advisory, but they're usually done very well, and you know, it's the rare case where I go above it, and he doubled it, more than doubled it.
Right, and you know, again, that this is the charges were on basically a technicality, and in fact, if Hastert hadn't opened the door to discussing and trying to turn individual A once again into a victim, we probably would never have known about this sordid background of Dennis Hastert.
Yeah, or even if he had played fair on the front end, even of the withdrawals. Because what happened was he made several large withdrawals when the payoffs first began. Then his bank informed him of, you know, federal guidelines, that it's a $10,000 limit. And so then Hastert turned around and made more than 100 withdrawals of just under $10,000 in a clear attempt to avoid that. So he sort of knew all along, the judge said, you very clearly knew what you were doing. You're a person of such stature. You can't make very many ignorance claims. You know, and there it is.
Including his initial claim that the reason he was withdrawing the money was because he didn't trust the banking system.
Yeah, I think he said he was buying antique cars. He came up with, you know, several reasons, none of which held water eventually.
Well, that's Jeff Cohen, investigative reporter for the Chicago Tribune. Jeff, thanks for the explanations here. I know it's a complicated and sordid story, but thanks for your good work on that, and thanks for getting up with me this morning.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
We'll be back with more right after this.